You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Good morning. It's my pleasure and honor to introduce Dr. Steve Kull to present his new book. I'm going to have him make a presentation about the book that will be about 25 minutes, and then I will ask our co-panelists to join us, and we'll have a conversation about the book. But let me make just a quick introduction. The book, as you can see up here, Feeling Betrayed, The Roots of Muslim Anger at America, which was just published by the Brookings Press, is really an excellent and timely book. And what makes it especially strong is that it's based on empirical data, much of which is original, much of which Steve has conducted over the past 5 years in a number of Muslim-majority countries. And it is also insightful because Steve himself is not only a pollster, that he's the director of the Program on International Policy Attitude next door, and also he directs the PIPA Knowledge Network poll among the U.S. public. He's been doing that for many years. He's an expert on public opinion, not only internationally, but particularly in the U.S. about the world. Has been doing that for a long time, but he's also a distinguished social scientist who has written a lot. He's a psychologist by training who has talked about political psychology. And this particular book is based not only on the polling, but as a good psychologist would, he had a lot of focus groups and visited many of the countries, talked with a lot of groups to provide a little more texture to the data that he was interpreting, and using his skills, his comparative analysis, his ability to understand public opinion and its role broadly beyond the Middle East and Muslim countries, and to compare it with what he knows about other regions and what he knows about American public opinion toward the region. That gives him a particular advantage that shows in this excellent book, and I think you'll see some of that here. Before I ask him to come to the podium to make his presentation, I also want to briefly introduce our co-panelist, Ambassador Wendy Chamberlain, who has still serves as president of the Middle East Institute since March 2007. She previously served as ambassador to Pakistan in 2001. And has had many other stints in the U.S. government over the years. She's a distinguished diplomat. She is a thoughtful analyst. She has been commenting on matters related to the Middle East and Muslim countries in the press. It's wonderful to have her to provide some perspective on the book. Let me start by asking Steve to make his presentation, and then we'll join him on the podium for a discussion. Steve, please.
Thank you, Shibley, for that introduction, and thank you all for coming this morning. And thanks to Brookings for setting up this event and for publishing the book. This book is a summary of research that was carried out starting in 2006 through 2010. And in the wake of 9/11, there were many studies done of Al-Qaeda and what was the nature of the hostility of Al-Qaeda toward the U.S. The goal of this study, though, is a bit different. It was to find out the nature of the support for Al-Qaeda and the hostility toward the U.S. in the broader Muslim society. And a premise of this study going into it was that a movement like Al-Qaeda cannot operate without some support in the broader society. Well, only a small number of Muslims really actively support Al-Qaeda. Still, those individuals arise from a culture, from a larger culture. And we wanted to find out the extent to which the attitudes in the larger culture provide the moral support and legitimacy to this anti-American effort. We also wanted to find out whether the larger Muslim culture shares Al-Qaeda's wholesale rejection of Western culture and liberal principles, because, of course, that it would be the basis for some finding some kind of common ground. And so we were looking to answer that question as well, whether in this broader culture there is some hope for finding some kind of common ground with the West in general and specifically with the U.S. Now, before 9/11, there was actually very little polling done in the majority Muslim countries. Based on what we do know, views were not particularly good. Views are pretty negative, with the exception of Indonesia and Morocco, though I say there wasn't too much known. Then after 9/11, starting in 2002, there was quite a lot of polling related to the war on terror and the Iraq war and so on. And views of the U.S. during that period in the Muslim world became quite negative. They also became quite negative throughout the world. Now, I should underscore that there is one big exception, a big asterisk here, which is Africa, and that in majority Muslim countries in Africa, you do not see the kinds of tendencies that you see in the rest of the majority Muslim world, North Africa, the Middle East, South Asia, and so on. And that's what I'm going to be focusing on. So just keep that on as an asterisk. So now during this period in the after 9/11, views of the U.S. had got quite negative all around the world. And that, but then after Obama was elected, that shifted quite dramatically, and we do not have a real big public diplomacy problem the way we did in the past, except in the Muslim world, with just a few exceptions. Here's a polling that comes from Pew and the Sadat chair that Shilby Talhami manages, asking this question about whether people have a favorable or unfavorable view of the United States. And just starting at the top there, you can see from 2006 through 2011, views did improve substantially in Indonesia, going from 30% favorable to 54% favorable. And in Lebanon, things are divided. But everywhere else you see that strong majorities continue to have an unfavorable view of the United States. And these ones for Egypt were done after the uprisings there. And you see there was no real improvement relative to 2008. So large majorities in Jordan, Pakistan, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, United Arab Emirates, Morocco, all of those have large majorities saying that the U.S. is they have an unfavorable view of the U.S. Now, in looking at this relationship between the broader public negativity toward the U.S. and anti-American terrorism, we found this to be a kind of useful model that I thought I'd throw up to start with about how this relationship works. Starting at the bottom there, you see kind of broad the base of the pyramid, these broad negative views of U.S. foreign policy. Now, out of that very large group rises as those who have a kind of passive of approval of anti-American terrorist groups. And then further up, you have those who actively support anti-American troops, and then finally you have actual anti-American terrorist groups. Going up the other side of the triangle, you have approval of attacks of U.S. troops, which is a rather large number, as I'll show you in just a moment, and then a smaller number who approve of attacks on U.S. civilians, and so on. But all of this is from our view, really one system, because the broad base is really what supports and, in a sense, sustains the smaller groups further up the pyramid, all the way to the terrorist groups themselves. So here are some examples. A fairly large number say that they approve at least of some of the groups that attack Americans, particularly in the Palestinian territories, Jordan, Egypt. You have clear majorities, Bangladesh, 49%, in smaller numbers, but still, these are rather substantial numbers of people in these societies that approve of groups that attack Americans. attacks on U.S. troops. This is the one we did in Iraq. We also asked about troops based in the Gulf and in Afghanistan, and the numbers were essentially the same. You have very large majorities approving or having at least some mixed feelings about attacks on U.S. troops in Iraq, especially in the Palestinian territories, Egypt, Bangladesh, Morocco, Jordan, Pakistan, and so on. And also, interestingly, in Iraq as well, in this particular case. So, but when you get on to attacks on civilians in the U.S., the numbers go down, but you still have a rather substantial number of people who do support attacks on civilians in the U.S. So this, you know, larger negativity creates what we call a good recruiting environment for al-Qaeda, for money as well as for foot soldiers. But so why is there this negativity? Find out more. We conducted the study, and I did focus groups in Egypt, Morocco, Pakistan, Jordan, Iran, and Indonesia, and then we polled in all those countries plus five more. We also pulled together the polling from other polling organizations, so that the book really is, in a sense, a comprehensive review of everything that's available. You know, from the focus groups, we developed questions, and then over the next few years went back and forth between focus groups and polls. And out of this process, we identified a widespread Muslim narrative of why they are mad at America. And it was really striking to me how common this was all the way from Morocco to Indonesia. They were singing off the same song sheet. There was more intensity. The closer you get to the Middle East, there's more intensity, but the themes are really very much the same. And this narrative has basically two levels. At the most immediate level, the one that you first encounter, Muslims express this feeling of being oppressed. At a deeper level, and I'm going to come to that more later, they have a feeling of being betrayed by America. And though these are different, I'll explain more as we go along. So, there are four key components to this narrative of oppression. The first is that the U.S. is coercively dominating the Muslim world, that it seeks to and largely succeeds in dominating the Muslim world using the threat of military force to shape it in ways that serve its interests. Yeah, this is really, to me, an interesting poll question that was actually done by Pew, asked, how worried are you, if at all, that the U.S. could become a military threat to our country someday? And as you can see, majorities in all of the countries say that they're at least somewhat worried. Even Kuwait, even Turkey. So there is this, and this is something that, you know, you ask, well, what did you learn? You know, what surprised you? And this is one of the things that really came through to me, is that the U.S. is really this 800-pound gorilla in the minds of people in this world, and it is, they feel threatened by it. I think it's like if you're in a restaurant and somebody walks in with an AK-47, you know, you get nervous, right? There is that potential for force to be used against you. And so there is this feeling of intimidation. Now, the guy with the AK-47 says, don't worry. I only use this on criminals, right? And somehow you still don't feel good. You know, I mean, who's going to decide who's the criminal? So, a question we asked was, do you think the United States does not use the threat of military force to gain advantages? And this is a real theme that came up, that the U.S. pushes people around to get these advantages. And as you can see, overwhelming majorities said that the U.S. uses the threat of military force. In our government's relations with the U.S., do you think the U.S. more often treats us fairly or abuses its greater power to make us do what the U.S. wants? And as you can see, majorities in every country except Jordan, interestingly, said that the U.S. abuses its power. These are some of the kinds of things that came out of the focus groups that we then formulated into poll questions and then tested to see how widespread they were. Now, a key theme that comes up is also that the U.S. tries to maintain control over Middle East oil. There is a perception that the U.S. has laid a claim on oil in the Middle East. That's even associated with the Carter Doctrine that's seen as codified, that the U.S. The U.S. can take the oil if you don't sell it to them, and they are trying to position themselves in that world to control, have this control. And again, overwhelming majorities in all countries say that this is a goal of the United States. And this is a kind of phrase that comes out of the focus groups. America pretends to be helpful to Muslim countries, but in fact, everything it does is really part of a scheme to take advantage of people in the Middle East and steal their oil. And you can see majorities or pluralities in every case agree with this statement. Now, there are arguments for the U.S. military presence in the region, which, as I say, people see as threatening. So we presented the counter-argument that that it's a stabilizing force. The U.S. military presence in the Middle East is a stabilizing force. Or do you think it provokes more conflict than it prevents? And as you can see, very few endorse the idea that it's a stabilizing force. So it's not surprising that majorities, large majorities, agree with Al-Qaeda's goal, and it's described as Al-Qaeda's goal, to push the U.S. to remove its bases and its military forces from all Islamic countries. And in focus groups, people are really quite explicit about this. So let me just give you a few examples of some things that people say in focus groups along the line related to this perception of coercive domination. The foreign policy of the USA is based on interference in the affairs of others, on aggression and domination. American policy falls within what we call the absolute will of power. The United States is pursuing a colonialism policy. The United States is a big power in a way that they rule other countries. And this is the one that this, again, sounds probably strange to our ears, but this is not uncommon. We have become their slaves. They just issue orders and we follow them. And here's an exchange that I had in Pakistan. Over here, the general public has the impression that the elected leaders are just pawns, that whatever happens in Pakistan happens according to the wishes of America. How does the United States get such leverage and capacity to influence decisions in Pakistan? Response: simply because it is a superpower. Since America, which is such a big power, gives some orders, the leaders in Pakistan agree to abide by them. Another says, we have elected the leaders, but at the end of the day, the power still lies with the United States. Now, something that came through, you know, again, this is another one of these ahas or surprises for me, was the extent to which people experience the U.S. as having overwhelming power. This phrase of the great Satan, I thought, oh, that was just sort of an epithet. But it views of the United States sometimes have a kind of cosmic quality, the power that's attributed to the United States. And, you know, the U.S. was behind 9/11. It completely controls the world media. And I said, well, what about Al Jazeera? Controls Al Jazeera? Some even say it controls Al Qaeda. Now, there was one case, though, in Iran where they were saying, oh, they control the media. They can get the media to do anything, convince anybody of anything. I said, well, why don't they control the media to give America a better image? I said, well, that's the one thing they can't control. That America's just so bad, you know, they can't make that change. So this came through so much. I formulated this question. It's kind of an odd question, but as how much of what happens in the world today would you say is controlled by the U.S.? Nearly all, most, some, very little. And you can see majorities say nearly all or most of what happens in the world today is controlled by the U.S. In Egypt, 59% said nearly all of what happens in the world today. And this, I know this looks like a strange question and number, but that is really, it really is part of what you see. Okay, next part of this narrative oppression. The United States is hostile to Islam and seeks to undermine it and to impose a secular social order or even Christianity. Asked about U.S. goals, large majorities in most cases say that it is a U.S. goal to weaken and divide Islam. It's also a U.S. goal to make Muslim societies less Islamic. Again, even, you know, Indonesia, So large majorities, and as you all see throughout, Egypt is one of the most has all of these perceptions, and to the greatest extent. It's also a U.S. goal, perceived U.S. goal, to impose American culture, with the exception of Azerbaijan. But here you see these very large majorities: 96% in the Palestinian territories, 89% in Pakistan, saying that it is such a goal. And we thought, well, what about now with Obama? Does Obama have this goal to impose American culture? Well, it was a little lower, but still, you have at least a plurality in most countries say that this is even Obama's goal. And even in Indonesia. So the Al-Qaeda goal of keeping Western values out of Islamic countries is a goal that large majorities agree with. And at this kind of, then we thought, well, let's ask about Christianity. And we kind of thought this, we didn't think this would really go very far, but large majorities even say that it is a U.S. goal to spread Christianity. It's kind of, it seems sort of contradictory. There are moments where they talk about secularization, but there are also moments where they talk about imposing Christianity. So let me give you an example of some of the things that people would say in a focus group. Now, this is a longer one because it gives you a really feeling of what the dialogue was like. And I want to underscore that this particular group of Egyptians was quite educated. I mean, there were even a few college professors in there. In Egypt, you have to stratify for focus groups, so they say. So here's an example. There is the hostile tone. This was done in 2008. There's the hostile tone that appears in the president's speech as he addresses Arabs or Muslims. This was obvious in his speeches after September 11, when he declared war on Muslims. He declared war between Christianity and Islam. I said, could you be more specific about what he said that made you think that? He stated that literally after September 11th, he said that they have to declare a crusade against Islam. And then I turned to the group and I say, how many here agree with that? And basically everybody nods. So I say, what does that mean? Somebody else says, this war has been there for a long time, but he declared this war after 9/11. It became very clear. Bush declared it openly. I say, well, what does it mean? It's a religious war, somebody says. So the goal of the war is what? The same as those of the Crusades, which we encountered throughout previous centuries. This is a key theme and one that Al-Qaeda plays along on a lot. I said, and these are to destroy, to eliminate the religion of Islam. And these are different people talking, joining in. If you want to support me or help me, don't come near my beliefs. You could be a friend. We can do business together. But when it comes to my religion, no. And I said, well, and America was trying to do this before 9/11 or only since 9/11? Well, the difference is that before 9/11, it was hidden. But after 9/11, it was declared and very obvious. I say, do you think with the new president is likely to continue? Yes, 80%. Well, who has this desire to destroy Islam, I ask? It's not the American people. It's the American politics. It's the government. I say, well, how does America undermine Islam? It helps other people kill Muslims in wars. For example, what happened in Iraq? So the attack on Iraq was an attack on Islam. It was a start. And somebody else says, well, there were other reasons, money among them. But one of the reasons was to fight Islam and to influence our own culture and traditions. Another example, a group of women, they talked about a war against Islam and efforts toward eliminating the Arab and Islamic identities. And I said, well, what does America do to eliminate Islam? Well, a few things together. It takes Israel's side. You kept silent while some countries attacked Islam. The matter is escalating. There are offensive internet games on the Islam and the Prophet. It also takes the rich countries' way to pressure the Arab world and consequently to weaken the Arab identity. Children's books in America or other Western countries have this strange introduction of Muslims. In this book, you find Muslims wearing jalabaya with a long beard, riding on animals, and carrying a weapon. This is the only image they give of a Muslim person. Okay, third component. Support for Israel. Now, this is interesting because both of the trends that we've talked about so far, this anti-Islamic prejudice and this effort to dominate the region kind of come together in this relation to Israel, where the U.S. supports and enables Israel in its victimization of the Palestinian people. Basically, what something that comes through is that the perception that there really is no barrier. There's a continuity between Israel and the U.S. There's a debate about whether how much Israel controls the U.S., how much U.S. controls Israel, but they're just basically a singularity. So we asked about the U.S. goal to expand the geographic borders of Israel. And in most countries, you had a majority saying that this is a U.S. goal. Support for the al-Qaeda goal to push the United States to stop favoring Israel in its conflict with the Palestinians. Large majorities in every case, not so much in Turkey. Does the U.S. have the goal to establish a Palestinian state? Well, interestingly, the Palestinians, 6 out of 10, think that it does. But for everybody else, large majorities think that it is not a goal. Now, let's try to go a little bit more into what is going on here. Why is there so much charge around the Israeli-Palestinian issue? Now, one is, as I already mentioned, there is this sense that it's a means to dominate the region. Here's one. The United States is supporting Israel to become a dominated country in the Middle East. America is using Israel as a military base in the Middle East. The United States wants to accomplish something in the Middle East or has certain politics it wants applied. It uses Israel as a tool to apply pressure on the Arab regimes to accomplish what America wants. But then there's another part of it, which is more focused on the Palestinians and the sense that the Palestinians are victimized. And this is, I think, a very powerful, iconic image of the whole relationship between the West and the Islamic world. Most of the time it's sort of vague, you can't really point at it, but here it is, right on your television screen, a visible, iconic image of how they feel broadly. And there is a person up there, and they identify with that person, and they can point at it, and they can say, see, that's what we're talking about. That's the feeling. That's their narrative. Here's an example. The bomb attacks on Palestine, this is by a Pakistani. The bomb attacks on Palestine by Israel were supported by the United States. When the Muslims throughout the world see this, they feel that the Americans have a very hostile attitude toward the Muslims. Another says, if you look at the oppression towards the Palestinians at the hands of the Israelites, then you as a Muslim wonder, why are we being targeted? This is where the differences develop. So there is this perception that it is rooted in this anti-Islamic prejudice. Fourth theme, the U.S. undermines democracy in the Muslim world so as to preserve its control and to ensure that Islamism is kept under wraps. This is the percent from one of Shibley's polls saying that democracy is not a real U.S. objective. Majorities in all cases except the UAE. And then we asked a little more complicated one. We gave three options. And the blue strip over there to the left are the number that says the U.S. favors democracy in Muslim countries, whether or not the government is cooperative with the U.S. The green section, the most common answer, is the U.S. favors democracy in Muslim countries, but only if the government is cooperative with the U.S. And then the red bar, which is a rather still substantial number, says say the U.S. opposes democracy in Muslim countries. A component of this is there is this perception that the U.S., America's opposition to Islamist parties, it's turning a blind eye to what happened in Algeria with the elections in 1990, is seen as more evidence that of an anti-Islamic view, and throughout the Muslim world, that view is largely rejected. Large majorities say that people should have the right to organize themselves into political parties and run candidates, including Islamist groups. Now, just a few quotes from the focus groups. Sometimes this was said in a kind of chiding way. An Iranian man said, if they have a problem with our political system, and then how is it that they accept the undemocratic political systems of regional Arab countries. But more often it's there's an anger that democracy is sacrificed for U.S. interests. U.S. leaders control every Arab and Muslim country. America's interference aims to keep these non-democratic regimes to serve its interest. In Pakistan's 60-year history, there's been very little democracy. Another example. When the United States supports any government, it's to achieve its own benefits and interests, not those of the government itself. Any political system in the Arab countries is merely a doll in the hands of the United States. They know it, and we know it. Now, on this theme of the Islamist parties, this is something that really bothers us, that comes up a lot. People talk about what happened in 2005 with Bush's State of the Union speech, and they say, oh, we got really excited, we were really positive, we thought, hey, things are really changing now, and then you let us down. When Hamas was elected, you turned, you cut off support, and one said, you asked for democracy, and when democracy brought Hamas to the government, you refused to deal with them. You severed all ties with Hamas group members. What democracy exactly are you talking about? And then others criticize this concern about Islamism and say, what's your problem with the Muslim Brothers? We're not worried about them, and you're just afraid of Islam and so on. All right, now I want to talk about this deeper narrative of betrayal, because this is what I've been showing you so far is the first thing that you encounter, the first layer that people present. But after a while, this other dimension starts coming to the surface, and it has a different tone. The first one is anger, anger at domination, anger at the colonializer, anger at the oppressor. And this one is different. It has a quality of disappointment. And implicitly, there is a kind of attraction to America, particularly to the kind of world order that America is promising and proposing, to the values that it presents, the liberal values. And I think this is a very important thing to understand. And then there's this disappointment, this sense of betrayal that America does not live up to these values. They talk about hypocrisy, double standards, and so on. And in these statements, there is a kind of implicit affirmation of those standards that the United States is not living up to. Here's an example. Two statements. The U.S. has been an important leader in promoting international laws and sets a good example by following them, versus the U.S. tries to promote international laws for other countries, but is hypocritical because it often does not follow these rules itself. And large majorities endorse the second view. Now, I just want to kind of map this out. The U.S., this dimension betrayal. So starting with coercive domination, there are these themes that come out about the principles that are contradicted. And these are principles of sovereign equality, of self-determination, the principle that there should be prohibition on all use of force or threat of use of force for unilateral gain. Principles of reciprocity, fairness, and respect in international relations. Relative to their hostility to Islam, the principle of religious tolerance, of freedom, that there should be no discrimination based on religion. In terms of enabling Israel's domination, that international law should be applied even-handedly. Also, a big emphasis on the theme of the NPT, the Non-Proliferation Treaty. And, why is it that Israel can have nuclear weapons? You go after Iran, but not after Israel. And it's interesting too, because by not talking about it, the U.S. implicitly says that it's kind of wrong. But this is another example of what is perceived as being unique to the Islamic world. Everybody else is treated one way, but here you've got this difference. And then, in terms of supporting autocrats, clearly the basic democratic principles of self-determination and also religious tolerance. Now, in the focus groups, when this came out, there was a kind of interesting dynamic where it felt like there was almost a plaintive tone, a kind of beseeching tone, I think of it as the U.S. is a lapsed democratic idealist, right? And there's some hope that it could wake up. Here's an example. I want to give you a message to America. This is an Egyptian woman. It's that America is a great country, known to maintain freedoms, democracies, and human rights. I wish that America would respect human beings everywhere and try to save lost human rights all over the world just as much as it is concerned about bin Laden. We all agree that America is capable of doing this. Now, these feelings often came up in the form of a linear narrative, that there was some earlier time when the United States was a kind of beacon of these values, and then they were let down. And people have different moments that they associate with this letdown. After 9/11. But we've always seen America as a source of enlightenment. But what we see now makes the people have negative feelings toward the American policy. Another, America represented a dream for science, freedom, enlightenment. But now America has successfully attracted the world's hostile feelings and attitudes, especially the countries that experience unjust treatment. Relative to 9/11, someone said, before 9/11, people always saw America enlightened and insightful. We don't see it that way anymore. Another example. After September 11, America lost credibility. It deviated from its normal path. It betrayed its ideals. Now, it's interesting that there is a set of norms that they have elaborated in their mind that are rather extensive, that they perceive the U.S. as having as violating, and it's there are a set of norms for how the hegemon is supposed to behave. I don't think they read Robert Cohen or anything like that, but they seem to have in some way internalized it. The nature of being the just a few more minutes. America is the strongest country in the world. Any president should consider this fact very well, that he's the president of the most powerful country. He has to be fair, and when it comes to applying standards, he should do it from a human perspective. There's a big emphasis that the U.S. has so much power that it has to in some way show restraint for there to be a truly symmetrical relationship. Example, the United States tries in every agreement with any country to have more rights than obligations. That's why we consider even the program signed by our government, if it's coming from the United States, it's made to fulfill their benefit more than ours. But many also talk about a kind of disjuncture between the American people and the culture. For me, I see this like a package that's sometimes black and sometimes pink. And that's because of the controversy happening inside it. There are two great contradictory forces. The first one is the civilian society, which is more cultured and more structured, the one who loves the good for the people. The second force is the government, who is aggressive, capitalist, exploiting others, trying to get the most profit. Here's another one. I have seen many Americans, and they are peaceful, and they are good. They behave in the right way, as they have to. They even treat their pets very well. When a cat is injured, they treat it so well. They want to behave in the same way with people, but not the American government. I think it would be in America's interest and the world as a whole if it holds to the ideals it promotes. And all of this, in a sense, points to this implicit affirmation of these ideals, these principles that they perceive as having a kind of common ground. And this is a fundamental rejection of Al-Qaeda. And when we presented the idea, thinking about Muslim and Western cultures, do you think that violent conflict between them is inevitable, or that it is possible to find common ground? And you know how Al-Qaeda answers this question. Majorities, or at least pluralities, say that they think common ground is possible. And this, again, is something that they say spontaneously in the focus groups. So we'll stop it there and open it up for some discussion.
Well, thanks, Steve. This is a very nice outline of the book, and I think it's faithful to what the book says. I'd like to, before I ask my colleague, Ambassador Chamberlain, to make some comments on the book, I'd like to offer a few of my own about the book. And I'm going to start with the strength that I see. I already mentioned some up front, but I also want to end with some a set of questions that I have about the book. As I mentioned earlier, I like the fact the book is not only based on solid evidence from the polling, and it's varied and over a 5-period of time, and actually uses other polls as well, including, I should say, mine. It has this texture that it adds through these, focus groups that give you a little bit more color and sometimes give you insight about what's behind the answers. And I think one of the strengths of the book is exactly what this lost theme that Steve talked about is this sense of betrayal. And that sense of betrayal, that is really an added value to explaining the attitudes in some ways, because it does tell you about this story of America's relations with the, Muslim majority countries and Arab countries particularly, where there is this anger on the one hand, and then there is attraction to values that a lot of people did not recognize for much of the past decade, because the theme here was, they hate us for our values. And that theme that came out of 9/11 turns out to be completely wrong. As we know, it turns out that people are, in the Arab world at least, are dying for our values, for freedom, democracy, are prepared to sacrifice their lives to protect them, to get them. It's exactly the opposite. Well, that theme, which Steve documents, we've been documenting over a decade, particularly in the Arab world, which is that, by and large, it isn't really a clash of values, although the values issue is a little bit more complex than people assume. And I think on that, too, Steve has some added value in terms of the internal debate within Muslim-majority countries about who they are and what the value story is. And so that's a strength. There's also a strength in the book about the evaluation of al-Qaeda itself, because there were a lot of specific questions about al-Qaeda here in ways that many of us have not really asked. In my polls in the Arab world, I ask really only a couple of questions about al-Qaeda, and they're more indirect, and they seem to coincide with the findings here. But this is far more information about their attitudes, the complex attitudes toward al-Qaeda. So all of that is really what makes this book excellent. But I want to raise some questions. Five related questions in a way. One is about, this notion of a Muslim world, which in some ways we kind of bought into after 9/11, and whether in fact it really does make sense to focus on a Muslim world. And we see what's happening today in the revolutions through the Arab world, certainly that hasn't really expanded into much of beyond the Arab world, where there is a theme of Arab identity, there is a theme of commonality focused on language and therefore media, that therefore has a consequence for the way that people see themselves, identify themselves, and also behave. Is there really a Muslim world? And in that sense, are we here asking questions about disparate people? And does this not matter, even if the findings are that there are common responses that you get in Muslim-majority countries, is it not at the end about priorities? And priorities, to give one example, you might have Egyptians and Pakistanis both give unfavorable views of the U.S., but how they rank issues matters a lot, and it varies across Muslim-majority countries, and particularly even across Arab countries. And one example in our polling in the Arab world, where we have, for example, the case of asking people to rank the issues that matter most in their evaluating American foreign policy. And what we find is the Afghan issue is not up there at all. even though if you ask them specific questions in the Afghanistan war, they probably would not be different from people in Indonesia or people in Malaysia. But about that is not a priority issue for them. It's not a prism through which they're evaluating American foreign policy. And that matters a lot as you make this evaluation. So how do you get around this? How do you make this distinction, differentiation? Do we want to not start walking away from this notion of a Muslim world? Does it help to think of a Muslim world? Second, a story about the timeline. And as the story about the timeline, this is Steve is very thorough. He actually goes far deep, particularly with other polls. But in his old polls, this is really a five-year period. And I wonder whether even in the past decade since 9/11, there's been a changing story, that this is not a static story. And in particular, when you look at particularly the attitudes about Al-Qaeda, the attitudes about terrorism, the attitudes about the U.S., immediately after 9/11, before the Afghan war, and even after the Afghan war, before the Iraq war, attitudes in Muslim-majority countries toward the U.S. were somewhat more favorable, or at least more open. And even the reaction in the U.S. toward the Muslim majority countries was different. It really started hardening after the Afghan war and the lead up to the Iraq war. And if you look, I was out in Azerbaijan just a few weeks after 9/11. I went to lecture at an Islam university, which is an Islamic university, all men. It was a packed room, a standing room only, a couple of hundred people. And I asked for an exercise. I said, how many of you do you believe bin Laden did it, 9/11? Not a single person raised their hand. How many people think this is an Islamic? Everybody raised their hand. Who do you think did it? They had a lot of conspiracy theories. But that is the initial reaction that we have to keep in mind that evolved. So what explains the evolution? It's not a static story. And in the 5 years before, the 5 years, the narrative changed. Third, while it's very good to analyze public opinion and the conflictive story, it's not always, of course, you have to take people seriously because much of what people see is a reflection of some reality. It's not just an imaginative world they're making up. And in particularly, the two cornerstone issues of attitudes in Arab and Muslim countries, but particularly in the Arab world, have to do with the U.S. military presence and the U.S. support for Israel. Those two are cornerstones. Now, actually, I'm a professor of international relations. I've been teaching international relations in the Middle East and American foreign policy in the Middle East for decades. Our texts tell the students America's foreign policy in the Middle East is driven by assuring the flow of oil to the West at reasonable prices and assuring the safety and security and well-being of the state of Israel, the cornerstones of American foreign policy. We assume that even as a matter of textbook. When you look around in the Arab world, America is present in everywhere, in the Gulf region. It's in Iraq, it's in Kuwait, it's in Bahrain, it's in the UAE, it's in Qatar, it's in Yemen. And so is this really the issues that people are talking about, they're not just made up in a matter of public opinion. There is a narrative that is based on some reality. Not all of it, but some of it. Now, how do you differentiate those two? Does it matter? I'm going to come back to that in the issue of recommendations. Fourth, the Arab awakening. Does the Arab awakening create a paradigmatic shift? Now, we don't yet know. I'd like to actually hear Steve's reflection on that. I know we have had one excellent poll from Pew in Egypt, which suggests that at least attitudes toward the U.S. have not dramatically changed in light of the revolution. But I suspect something stronger is going on, and we see it. For example, the most striking thing about Arab attitudes toward the world since the Arab revolutions is the seeming embrace of the Arab public of Western intervention in Libya. Extraordinary. If you put that in perspective of Arab fear of imperialism that we also see exhibited in the polls, and if you contrast that with the attitudes toward the Iraq war, something is unique that has taken place. And even if we measure that these favorability views have not diminished, have not increased because of Arab revolutions, maybe what's going on here is that this issue is no longer a priority issue to them. That is, yes, they still don't have negative views of the U.S., but that's no longer maybe a central theme. I'm asking that question. I'm not making that as a finding. We need to probe a little bit more. Maybe something else is going on. And that brings me to the final point, which is the point of recommendations. Obviously, you cannot detach recommendations from real policy recommendations, because there are excellent recommendations that are in the book about how to deal with this problem of attitudes toward America, that Steve makes an excellent case that they matter and why they matter and why they're consequential and why they're consequential for America's war on al-Qaeda and its allies. And I happen to embrace that, support it fully, that these things matter, that our approach matters in concrete ways for policies. It's not just winning public opinion, but winning public opinion is an essential component of fighting the war on al-Qaeda. But I wonder whether you can really make an analysis of recommendations without full analysis of what the policy options are. Let me give you two examples of the recommendations that are in there. One is to separate the U.S. from Israel as much as possible. That sounds reasonable. I mean, I think that at one level that's what you find in the events. But is that really realistic to expect? And if not, then what do you do about it? For example, the Prime Minister of Israel will be here, this weekend. He will give an important speech to Congress, and he's likely to get full support in Congress for his views. And that's going to play back in the Arab world, and that's not going to change, because you can make that recommendation, but it's not going to make Congress change its mind on what it's going to do. So then what do you do about that? And that's the thing that has to follow. And the final recommendation, there are a lot of good recommendations in there, but I'll mention one more, which is essentially to be patient with Arab democracy in ways that we have not been in the past. And that's a reasonable recommendation, because you can see what happened back in 1989, when there was an experiment after the end of the Cold War to embrace openings in the Arab world, and then Iraq invaded Kuwait, and everyone went to a different mode of analysis and backtracked from democracy. The same thing happened in some ways later on in the 1990s and even into the decades since 9/11. So that at the face of it is a very reasonable, good recommendation, particularly as we see events unfolding in the Arab worlds in a way that is inspiring, with people really seeking to have more opening, more freedom, and a lot of them are apparently more liberal than many here assumed. But is that also realistic? I mean, if you have an election in Egypt that leads to the Muslim Brotherhood winning, that then freezes relations with Israel, will Congress really be patient? I don't think so. And then if it's not, how do you deal with it? And so I'd like to hear more about how you build these recommendations into the realistic policy options. I'll end with that, and I invite my colleague Ambassador Chamberlain to present her comments.
Well, I find it's an extraordinarily good book, a good presentation, and I thank both of my colleagues for their presentation. A lot of the data that we saw today at the screens were actually collected before the seminal events that occurred this year in 2011. Some of it was not. But a lot of the data is still quite relevant to practitioners, diplomats, former diplomats like myself, because you need to understand the context when you begin to make foreign policy. And this wonderful books like this does provide the context. It does enable us to understand the attitudes of people that we are conducting diplomatic relations with, and that's an enormous contribution. If you look at, I'd like to take this up to the present, though, 2011. You look at the Arab Spring. It had really kind of nothing to do about the United States. What was happening in Tahrir Square and in Tunisia was really very inward. The people were, you've heard this before, but they were looking at their own relationship with their own governments, their own economic situation, and they were making demands that had everything to do about their aspirations and their families for the future. But what it did show was that this anger towards the United States that is well documented in Steve's book did not come out as a narrative in the streets. On the other hand, it had everything to do about the United States, because what they were demanding in Tahrir Square from their governments were really reflective of the values that the United States has represented for decades. It's been the values that have been an important part of our diplomacy, our public relations, our aid programs. It was peaceful demonstrations. It protected, it was tolerant towards minorities. They were demanding citizen participation in government democracies. For that, those were all fundamental American values. But I really caution, and I think everybody in this auditorium would agree with me, this is not the moment for triumphalism. This is not the moment for us to be tooting our horn about the success of our diplomacy over the years, because that would undo it all. It is the tact that we have been taking in our diplomacy has been sort of as a trying to be as much as we possibly can a passive observer, even though the administration has received some domestic criticism for that. It is the only way to actually encourage the positive elements of what we've seen in the Arab Spring so far this year. But really what worries me as a former ambassador and diplomat and practitioner is really the future. And I think Shibley made some of those points a few moments ago. We are looking at a couple events that are coming up over the next several months that could represent a hardening of attitudes against the United States that will shut the door to some of the maybe little bit of opening the doors that we've seen in the Arab Spring. And the first event in the future could be as soon as tomorrow, when President Obama gives a speech where he gives his reflections on what has been happening in 2011 throughout the Middle East. And most analysts are telegraphing to us that he probably will say very little about the Palestinian-Israeli peace, other than to repeat what he is and stress what has been American policy for a long time, and that is that the parties should negotiate direct, face-to-face at the negotiating table. This will not be good news to most of the people throughout the Middle East, because what they're waiting and wanting and yearning to hear from the United States is that we will step up, we will put down our own plan, very clear as to what the steps, what the elements of those of that plan is, but that we will get behind it and try to move it forward, because the whole notion of negotiating face-to-face at the table has really not gone very far, and they don't anticipate that it will without American more aggressive American involvement. So I think you're going to hear tomorrow some disappointment from across the Muslim communities. And a second point where I think we're going to get a hardening of attitudes throughout the Arab community and Muslim community will be in September, when the Palestinians take to the General Assembly the resolution to have the UN create a Palestinian state bypassing negotiations. And if we're to believe all analysts at this point, every country in the world will vote for that resolution except United States, Israel, and I don't know, maybe Samoa. But again, we will be isolated. And again, this will be a pivotal point where attitudes will harden against us. And a third danger point in our diplomacy throughout the region is really in the Gulf, where our traditional partners, the monarchies, the ruling families of the Gulf, are seeing the events very differently than we see them. We, of course, are encouraged by this sweep of democratic values. We look at what's happening in Bahrain with dismay, primarily as a Sunni Shia minority rights being oppressed. They don't see it that way. They don't discount that that's happening, but they primarily see it as a time of turmoil when Iran is using for aggressive Iranian nationalism that is threatening them in the Gulf. And their policies over the last decade have been to turn to the United States, to rely on us, pay for it, as their security guarantor, and they are criticizing us for not being a reliable guarantor at this time. And we're beginning to see some unraveling of that compact that we've had in the Gulf over the decades. They're looking towards China and Russia for equipment buys. They're acting independently by sending troops into Bahrain. They're circling the wagons around Sunni monarchies by bringing in Morocco and GCC and Jordan into the GCC. None of us could have envisioned this a few months ago. But that leads to, and I will make three suggestions for how this is meaningful as we look to the future in American diplomacy. The first is we need to double down on our dialogue with our traditional partners to reassure them of our relationship with them as a guarantor of security against external threats, but also to dialogue with them more about the importance of democratic openings. Secondly, we need dialogue with the American people. And I think both my colleagues mentioned this. The American people need to understand that as you move towards greater democracy, creation of political parties and new political parties in Tunisia, in Egypt, in Jordan, that some of these political parties are going to be Islamist in nature. And that this should not and does not represent a threat to the United States. They clearly will not represent our interests, but that's not an existential threat to us. And our public needs to understand that and be more accepting of it. And finally, the success of this democratic spring throughout the Middle East is extremely important, particularly in Egypt. That's the long pole in the tent. And it's already beginning to get frayed around the edges as the people are saying to themselves, and we're beginning to hear this, hey, I don't see what this, how this has helped me. How is this helping I still am jobless. The economy's in tatters. In fact, it's worse now than it was before. What's changed except that it's getting worse? So I think there's a challenge there to the international community. And it's an economic, financial challenge to work, as an international effort to inject, assistance, capital, job creating projects, debt reshaping, enterprise zone, whatever you can possibly think of, but to do it immediately, particularly in Egypt, but also in Tunisia and Jordan, et cetera, because this must not fail. This is an incredibly important moment in history. There are people within our government who understand this. They're kind of running up against a budget wall, because up on the Hill, they're talking, they have other concerns about holding down that budget. So there are some conflicts here, but we must understand that this is a critical moment for our diplomacy, our interests, and for the interests of the people in the Middle East, and that we must seize that. Thank you.
I'm gonna turn to Steve just for a few comments and response or explanations, and then I'm gonna open up for questions.
I just want to make a few quick comments. I did not say that the United States should separate from Israel. I talked about the United States differentiating itself from Israel, which doesn't necessarily imply any movement apart. In fact, I even suggested that the United States should formalize its security treaty with Israel, that the U.S. does not now have a security commitment. It's implied vaguely in public statements, which then creates a sort of ambiguity of a kind of boundaryless relationship between the U.S. and Israel, and that the relationship should become more differentiated but also deeply related. But the combination of these two things of clarifying and even strengthening the security commitment at the same time that there is this kind of differentiation, so that we're not necessarily responsible, nor do we hold ourselves out to be responsible for everything that Israel does. I have more to say about it, but it's in the book. On dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood, the moderate Islamists, the word I use is that we should take a friendlier posture. And I think, for example, right now there's talk in Congress about that the democracy development money, that none of it can go to Islamist groups. And so if we have a seminar on developing political parties or something like that, I suppose we need to have somebody guarding the door to make sure that no members of the Muslim Brotherhood come in. I think that's very problematic. It sends a very negative signal. It is perceived as being an anti-Islamic posture. We need to be very clear about the difference between moderate and radical Islamists, and that the dividing line is about the use of force in service of that. I do think that if we, in relation to Egypt right now, if we take a negative, hostile posture toward the Muslim Brotherhood, it will actually strengthen the Muslim Brotherhood. It will strengthen Islamist tendencies in Egypt, because people, when they perceive that the United States is hostile and threatening to Islam, it pulls them closer to Islam. It makes them identify more deeply with it, and in a way that then it becomes politicized. So I think that the backlash that will occur from an unfriendly posture toward Islamist parties is going to be more problematic. And that there are countries where we have not, like Pakistan, where we have not taken that posture toward the Islamist parties there. We have a fairly friendly attitude, and they are small and remain small. Quickly on the post-Arab awakening, the polling there about Pew did 5 or 6 countries, and basically there's no indication of change so far. And in Egypt, there's pretty much a stance of, you know, you were kind of behind the late to the party, and so the U.S. hasn't really gotten credit for that. It's something that happened despite the U.S. I think, though, with time, that there is potential for change to occur, but there isn't a perception that the U.S. caused this to happen and that the U.S. is getting credit for it. But I think that there are possibilities. I mean, the U.S. didn't intervene to stop it, and many Egyptians previously said things to the effect that they thought that the U.S. would under these circumstances. So I do think that there is the potential for these changes to lead to an improved relationship.
Great. Well, thanks very much. We have time for some questions, and I'm happy to take some. And please identify yourself when you ask the questions. Please, on the right.
I'm Joseph Bosco, retired Defense Department. Comment to Shibley and a question for Mr. Cole. Shibley, you said that the idea that
The microphone doesn't appear to be working. Maybe we can turn it on.
You made the statement that the study disproves the idea that they hate us for our values. You said that clearly they don't hate our values. The they that we were talking about when we said that was Al-Qaeda, not the Arab and Muslim worlds. So I think we should be clear on that. As for Mr. Colt's study, I'm curious to whether you asked the question about Arab and Muslim attitudes toward U.S. interventions in Bosnia, Kosovo, Kuwait, Somalia, where we defended Muslims against both Christians and other Muslims. If you did not ask that question, I'm curious as to why not. If you did, I wonder what the responses were.
I did explore it in focus groups, people kind of recognize that seems like an anomaly, but in each case they emphasized that the U.S. had interests that it was pursuing and that it wasn't an indication of the U.S. as in a sense trying to help Muslims. So it's like when you've got a dominant narrative that people are invested in, it can be pretty resilient against disconfirming pieces of information or action. And it doesn't mean at a certain point that there won't be a shift, but that certainly has not happened.
Just a comment on this. I agree the Bush administration made it clear what they meant was Al-Qaeda and terrorist groups. But I think in our discourse, really the boundaries slipped. And there was a discourse in which the impression was given that it's much broader. And people didn't differentiate the anger that is being mapped out in the polls from this issue of it. We're speaking about these limited groups who get limited support for agendas. In Al-Qaeda, for example, in the poll that I did in the Arab world, when you asked them what aspect of Al-Qaeda, if any, do you find attractive? The first answer, of course, is the fact that they stand up to the U.S. The second is that they speak for causes they believe in. But only about 6% over the decade have said they embrace their agenda of a Taliban-like state. That's not insignificant. I mean, it's a minority that is measurable, but it obviously is a very small minority in the Arab world.
I just want to add that there is the whole notion of the clash of civilizations, Sam Huntington, Bernie Lewis, and they do talk about the fundamental problem being one of different values and tension, hostility between two value systems. So it wasn't just that they hate our values in reference to Al-Qaeda.
Yeah, Newton Rose, unaffiliated. I got a question about polling. Who are you polling? If you poll people in the United States and ask them something about the Middle East, there are people in the United States who don't even know where the Middle East is. So when you go into Egypt, has 81 million people, and you go in, who do you poll? Is it all in Cairo, elite? Did you go to the Delta? Do you speak Arabic, or do you speak Egyptian Arabic?
Some of the polls are conducted nationwide, and some of the polls are conducted in major cities. In all cases, they are selected through a process of random sampling. They were all conducted face-to-face, going to people's homes.
Do these people have to have some knowledge of
They're randomly selected. They're the people.
That's the problem with polling.
Representative sample.
Can I just make a comment?
I'll just make a
comment to your point. It's very true that many people in the United States are much more interested in domestic issues, family issues, their own economic issues, and do not have much interest in foreign policy or foreign issues. I have found that this is not true abroad. In fact, it's the inverse. And let me take a country I know a little bit better than most, Pakistan, where close to 50 to 70% are illiterate. Now, one would assume that in a country where majorities and most of the majority of the women are illiterate, that their understanding of what was happening outside of Pakistan and foreign policy issues would be very little. The inverse is true. There are 59 and growing number of televisions, radio stations. They are fascinated, fixated, obsessed with the United States, obsessed with what's happening in the region. The level of understanding, attention to foreign policy issue is very great. Now, that doesn't mean it's informed, because that doesn't mean that the news they're getting from their privatized television stations is accurate. In fact, a lot of it is just repeating some of the conspiracy theories that we saw reflected in the polls. But they were informed. They were interested and making their decisions based on what they heard from their own news agencies.
Hi, Tracy with Amity's, Tracy Rogers. I just have a quick question with regards to the actual root of Muslim anger in America from a psychological standpoint. Would you say that overall it has a lot to do with flat-out projection, projection of their own ideals, projection of Muslim community and ability to really create democracy, create democratic practices, especially when they contradict Islamic practices? Would you say that overall, from a psychological standpoint, could be the root of the anger?
Let me take a couple of more before we answer. Go ahead.
My name is Mohammed Qasim, and I'm an economist, now historian. I'm troubled by this treatment of this world as a homogeneous block of ignorant so-and-sos, whether it's religion or it's the Arab world. You know, Arab is not one ethnic group. And I'm an Ismaili, and we have been persecuted and slaughtered by the Sunni Arabs for centuries. And the only time we feel safe is under Anglo-Saxon rule. And that applies to Abadirs and a host of other people. And then this conflating individual despots with a country. Iraq invaded Kuwait. No, Saddam invaded Kuwait. Thing goes on, like even when Mubarak was kicked out, he was saying, Mubarak, our ally. Ben Ali, our ally. King this, our ally. What does that make the people who are rebelling? Our anti-allies? Enemies? This message is there. So, I don't know. You call a shanty in this game, better do some exercise.
Okay, we'll take one more before we go ahead. In the back. Please identify
Hossein yourself. Hossein Shahbazi with Webster University. I want to actually take you back to policy and what Ambassador Chamberlain said about future. And the question is about you, Ambassador, you raised a good point about one of the problems that you identified about the Persian Gulf. And as the Gulf countries are, you know, circulating around the wagons, and they're kind of not sure about our support. I like to connect to the presentation by Professor Cole about double standard and the hypocrisy they see. How the policy that U.S. is pursuing, by not even talking much about what Bahrainis are doing to the people, and how that could be perceived as part of our helping or solving the hypocrisy perception that Middle Eastern have, as well as how can you also suggesting that we should, you're recommending that we have to have continued dialogue with them. When you are going to advise that, how the American administration is going to avoid the not talking about their measures they have taken against their people and yet, you know, having a dialogue with them. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Why don't you go ahead and take that?
First on this question of projection, I have, if I had a few more minutes, I would have talked about what I call the inner clash of civilizations. That there are, if you take a whole set of poll questions, you could get results that look contradictory, where there are very positive attitudes about liberal values. The will of the people should be the basis of governance. But you also have very large, you know, huge majorities saying that. And then huge majorities saying Sharia should be the only basis for law, right? So that's just an example of different cases where there is this tension. The way I see it is that there is this very strong commitment to an Islamic foundation to their identity and an attraction to liberal values, an attraction to globalization, attraction to democracy, and so on, and a kind of reaching out. At the same time, there's a great fear of being overwhelmed. And then the United States comes in economically and militarily and is perceived as trying to impose, trying to destroy their Islamic culture. And when that happens, they kind of hunker down and resist and identify with Islam even more strongly and reject liberal values. But at the same time, it's still very much alive. So it's really an inner conflict. And when we get inside the conflict and we play out one side of it, it actually pushes them more toward the other. And that's mostly problematic because it interrupts their process of working through, of integrating these different elements, assimilating liberal values, assimilating relations with the larger world. On the question of the Muslim world, you know, and Shibley brought this up too. You know, it's always that's always a question. You know, well, if we talk about the Arab world, how can you talk about the Arab world? There are all these different countries. Within these countries, how can you talk about each country? There are different regions and different. So it's always that way. And the question is whether if you take the whole sweep, whether there are common themes. And I was struck, whether I was in Morocco or Indonesia, there were the commonality of themes. And as we went through these poll numbers, it was extremely rare that you found real division. For most questions, there was a large majority agreeing up and down the line. So yes, there are very many differences, important differences. And I think that you can say that there are some common themes. You can say there are common themes in the Western world in terms of values as well. As well as there being differences. So that was what I was attempting to explicate, was this common narrative that you find throughout the Muslim world, which doesn't mean that there aren't also important differences, and that maybe the term at times is used too freely and on an implicit assumption that there are no significant differences. If I understood correctly on the question of not talking to Hamas, that is going to be perceived as the U.S. being inconsistent but not following through on its democratic principles and being anti-Islamic. That doesn't mean, though, that people in that part of the world don't understand that there are things that Hamas has done that are contrary to certain principles that the U.S. has. So it's not that they don't have any thought processes in there that have some understanding of why the U.S. is taking that position. But the dominant perspective will be one of perceiving the U.S. as being once again inconsistent.
Good. Well, thank you, and I'm glad for that question because I need to clarify it, and I don't want to be misunderstood. That was the third point in three danger points towards American diplomacy that I was outlining. Let me interpret the language of a diplomat. When a diplomat says we need to double down on dialogue, that means we've got a problem here. And we need to talk to our friends, talk to our allies, make certain that they understand our position, because we think that not just our relationship, but we think the events are headed in the wrong direction. And I think that's certainly true in Bahrain. Some of the human rights violations there have been over the top. Some of the interpretation within the region by people who we have very strong and historical relationship with, we have disagreements. And that calls for greater dialogue. And that's what I was suggesting.
I'm going to take just a couple of last questions, and then we'll go with a round here. We'll take one in the front and one in the back.
Okay, my name is Richard Hyde. I'm a theologian, and I've got a historical question for Professor. What if you had taken this poll, say, 150 years ago and asked people about the local hegemon at the time, namely the British Empire, how would this polling data have come out, similar or different? I mean, give us an idea of the historical roots of these perceptions. Is it just America, or is it Europe or the West, et cetera?
Yeah. And there's one person right there on the back on the right.
Robert Shred, international investor. Stephen, we've given you great credibility in the past for some of your surveys. And in defense of surveys, I'd like to say we certainly find that it is more reasonable to believe in what a large group of people might say, however accurate or inaccurate, rather than a national tendency being characterized by somebody, a politician or somebody from our Defense Department. Too often we have to rely on just their ability to capture how a nation might feel. So I think surveys are critical. And my question is, going forward, are you working on anything where perhaps universities around the world can continue to provide survey data on how their nation's civilians and citizens feel about any of these issues?
Wait, now the last one right here.
Stephen, your initial presentation, you mentioned there were different groups of Muslims that could be categorized on their degree of militancy, attacking U.S. forces, attacking U.S. civilians within the region or U.S. Does your data allow you, this is for foreign policy formulation purposes, allow you to look at, distinguish the views of those various say groups according to their militancy toward the U.S. and West?
Great. I want to take the first question very quickly about what it looked like before. I just remind people, this whole, the inception of the contemporary political system in the Arab world came as Arabs revolted against the Islamic Ottoman Empire in support of a Western-led British Empire that promised them freedom. So it started that way. And right after, when Woodrow Wilson sent a commission to find out what Arabs really wanted, said, if we want independence, we can't have it. We prefer an American mandate over any of the European mandates. And please don't make it the French. And in 2010, when George W. Bush was still identified by most Arabs as the single most disliked leader in the Arab world, France was number one in almost every category of popularity in the Arab world, another Western country. So you look at that whole century from changing tides, and you can't say it's about values. It's very hard to look at that sweep of history and say it was about values. It was clearly about policies.
The theme that we heard over and over was, you say you are different than all those colonializers, all those hegemons that have come in here over the centuries, but you're not. Well, we wish you would. You wish you would be. In a way, we think you are, but you're not. You know, so they go, this is the cycle that they go through. And there's this, when I titled the book Feeling Betrayed, that's really what it's about, which is that there is this sense that with the Suez Crisis, there was an example where the U.S. really came from a more principled position. And there are other examples where they see America as acting differently than traditional colonial powers, but then it slips off. In terms of availability, yes, we have on our site, worldpublicopinion.org, we have a lot of data on public opinion around the world. And we also on the Council on Foreign Relations site have a series of digests where we pulled together in this comprehensive way polling from all around the world, organized around certain themes and analyzed. So I recommend both of those. In terms of militancy, and yes, we've tracked those and we're in the process of analyzing it more deeply. What are the predictors of greater militancy and greater readiness to support the use
of force and terrorism and so on. And Evan Lewis here is writing a dissertation on the subject, taking all the data we have and doing a very thorough analysis. So I'm sure he'd be glad to talk about the state of that development.
Well, Steve, I'd like to congratulate you on an excellent book.
Thank you.
And I would like to thank you for joining us for a discussion. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen.